We'll move on to our next session. Thank you, Seth. Let's give you a round. And don't forget your evaluation sheets.
Could you repeat everything you said before we got in?
This is hard to see.
Let's see, the community crisis at the reorganized.
Yes.
When did you guys change your name?
2001.
Work out okay?
It did. It worked great.
Excellent.
Do you want me to leave the last chapter to the next presenter? Which I have no problem doing. As long as there's some questions of the gospel. What do you have?
I don't know what they have in mind, so. Let me mark the program real quick, if you don't mind. That way I can see what.
Do we have a session in this room next?
Yes, we do. We have.
What?
We're in room C.
Can we get to the strike? Your slide projector there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right there. And.
Well, I need to set
mine
up right now.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I'm missing a page in the middle of my.
Were you at the middle section?
That's why.
Okay, we're in room.
We're in room C.
And we have the. Confine them to their own species presentation.
Okay. The no risk side.
You want a little chip?
Yes.
Perfect. All right.
So.
Most people.
Well, but you want to use.
I'm going to use PowerPoint projections. No, I'm not going to.
You're going to do a PowerPoint then?
So who's our editor, I hope.
He's actually using an overhead projector.
Stay away from the screen, I guess, yeah. So we got to stay to one side, I guess. So you're using a projection, but you're going to be giving a
record presentation that happens.
I'm still working through my comments. I have some additional. So my commentary is still a work in progress.
So is my paper.
Yeah, well, I noticed there were a few areas, you know, I called you on the one. Yeah. Said, all of a sudden, you know, there was a transition there that was missing between... You talk about Joseph Smith, and all of a sudden we're talking about William McCary.
Yeah,
there's a line, at least a line missing there. So.
Where's the outlet here? Michael, he's gone. Well, I guess.
Let's see, is there a plug? Yeah, there's a plug. There's an outlet. Both plugs are the bolt light.
Okay. Gosh, I came prepared. Because I have yet another extension cord. I don't know. Hopefully it'll reach.
Is
it
going to make it?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. We're okay then. Well, that's good. It's always good to have an extension
for it. I'm trying to come prepared with all the disasters.
Yeah, for every contingency, right?
Yep. Chair is.
I don't know either. I guess what we're supposed to start about. I guess we're supposed to start. I guess we. I know that we want to have plenty of time for the paper. I'm not really the chair of this session, but I'm actually the commentator. My name is Newell Bringhurst. And I'm gonna, I guess, wear both hats as chair and as commentator. And it's my great pleasure to introduce my good friend Conal O'Donovan. Where we've kind of become a tag team here. I mean, I always end up not coming out on the short end of this because I'm the short guy, the little guy here. But, we've done this tag team routine. I guess now this must be the. Fourth time I think that we've been on either a Sunstone session or an MHA session or a John Whitmer. I think we've done all three sticks. So we kind of do this routine traveling around the country and Conal is mid-level administrator at UC Santa Cruz. That's what he does for his daytime job.
Right.
But he's a professional agitator, as you heard last night. He also has a good singing voice.
Oh,
too.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure. I'm loud.
He knows by heart Saturday's Warrior.
All the lyrics. I knew them all by heart.
That was inside of Conal that I was unaware of. But the side of Conal that I've gotten to know very well is the prodigious writing and scholarship that he has done on the topic of blacks in the early church. When I took on this topic many years ago, many, many years more than I would care to remember, back in the early 1970s, I remember it was just right after Stephen Taggart's book had come out, the little book that he did, and I remember my doctoral advisor at the University of California, Davis, W. Turrentine Jackson, said, "That completely wipes out your research. You've got to change topics immediately." Wait just a minute. And that was even before Lester Bush's even more definitive article. It was about the same time that his more definitive article had come out. And if he'd seen Lester Bush's article, he would have even been more crazy. But the point that I'm trying to make here is even once Lester Bush had completed his definitive study and that followed by research done by other path-breaking people like... Armand Moss and others, as well as my own research, we just felt like we barely scratched the surface. And the recent research that Connell has done further indicates that there's so much more work that is can be done, and that it is a very much of a vital ongoing subject for future analysis. And the findings that he's going to share with you today indicate the breadth and the excitement of the new findings that are coming up regarding African Americans within Mormonism over the course of 150 years. So, go ahead.
No, well, thank you very much. I can't wait for my paper to be over so you can harshly criticize me.
Move this around a little bit here.
First slide, please. We'll call them slides. So we'll start off with Lester Bush. In his 1973 pivotal article, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine and Historical Overview, he said an aversion to miscegenation, or which is race mixing, has been the single most consistent facet of Mormon attitudes towards the Negro. Though the attitudes towards the priesthood, slavery, or equal rights have fluctuated significantly, denunciations of interracial marriage can be identified in discourses in virtually every decade from the Restoration to the present day. Indeed, fear of this juxtaposition of race and sexuality is the very seed that germinated into the post-1847 priesthood ban, which prevented anyone of known black African descent from holding LDS priesthood and from participating in LDS temple endowment and sealing rituals. The latest research on this issue, including my own biographies of black elders Q. Walker Lewis and Joseph T. Ball, and then Stephen Fleming's work on William I. Appleby's journal, and Patrick Polk's research on Warner McCary, points conclusively to Brigham Young's personal fear of black sexuality, and especially black male sexuality, as the reason he emphatically prohibited black-white marriage and instigated the priesthood temple ban. Young's resistance to black-white marriage must also be seen within the context of his own marital experimentation, which was at that very moment in 1847 receiving national public scrutiny and condemnation, as well as legal censure by the Massachusetts State Supreme Court. In this paper, I first examined a significant LDS marriage that occurred in Massachusetts in 1846, and I place it in its historical context. Next, I briefly examine interracial marriage in Nauvoo, beginning with Joseph Smith, and then carry that topic on to winter quarters of 1846 and 47, where the seeds of LDS anti-miscegenation fully germinated under Brigham Young. Next, I recall Brigham Young's emerging theology regarding black-white marriage and its significance to American society and LDS eschatology. When I look at the chaotic consequences of letter of the law dogma conflicting with the lives of real people who openly came to LDS leaders to ask difficult personal questions or demand clarification and concise definitions rather than broad generalizations. Despite seemingly rigid doctrines and policies, in reality, the responses from church leadership were widely varied and often contradictory, with many more people of at least some African descent receiving priesthood and temple ordinances than has been acknowledged in the past. Next, I reveal previously unknown statements and ideas about black-white marriage and white racial superiority as found in the Deseret News from 1864 to 1910. And lastly, I examine how LDS doctrine influenced Utah territorial and state laws on black-white marriage, resulting in a small but influential and ultimately successful civil rights movement in Utah and within Mormonism that called on LDS leaders to abolish antiquated and unnecessary restrictions on the boundaries of love and marriage. Next slide. I woke up not feeling very well this morning, so I'm like a little nauseous. Hopefully we can get through this. Ultimately, this paper shows that LDS doctrine and practice maintained that civil marriages, specifically between blacks and whites, were categorically prohibited, were unnatural and contrary to God's law, would never be acceptable within the LDS Church, or if so, only in some future eschatological period. They were deeply offensive to social norms, and if allowed to be performed, would lead to the destruction of not just society, but indeed humanity. And I'm going to read that paragraph again, but I'm going to slightly change it. LDS doctrine and practice maintains that civil marriages of same-sex couples are categorically prohibited, are unnatural, and contrary to God's law, will never be acceptable within the LDS Church. They are deeply offensive to social norms, and if allowed to be performed, will lead to the destruction of not just society, but indeed humanity. Now, in 1963, Utah finally accepted legalized black-white intermarriage. And then in 1978, the LDS Church accepted it doctrinally, although begrudgingly. And black-white sealings are now performed in temples across the world. And the prophesied divine retribution and utter destruction of humanity have not happened. One of the most significant and simultaneously most obscure marriages in LDS history took place on September 18, 1846. On that day, 21-year-old Enoch Lovejoy Lewis married 19-year-old Mary Matilda Webster in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I only show this part of the marriage register is like 20 feet long, so on one slide I can only just show their names. At first glance, this couple and their marriage seemed rather unremarkable. Both were members of the LDS Church in the Lowell, Massachusetts branch. The young bride, Matilda, was from Chester, Massachusetts, a tiny rural village in the southwestern area of that state. Her parents didn't marry until she was almost 2 years old, so Mary was either illegitimate or one of her parents had a previous unknown marriage. The importance and uniqueness of this marriage lies in the fact that Matilda's groom, Enoch Lovejoy Lewis, was the son of a black father and a mixed-race mother. And Matilda, the name that she went by, was white. 3 years after Massachusetts repealed its ban allowing white people to marry either those of African or Native American descent, this interracial marriage of a white Mormon woman and a black Mormon man ignited a firestorm in the LDS Church, and its effects are still being felt today. William Lloyd Garrison is credited with launching the campaign to repeal the 1705 Massachusetts law barring marriages between white people and those of African descent. Although black abolitionists had certainly desired this long before Garrison began his campaign. The very second issue of his newspaper, The Liberator, this is January 8, 1831, included an urgent appeal for the obliteration of the 1786 law, which made performing an interracial marriage a crime punishable by a fine of £50, which is about $7,000 in today's money. Garrison wrote that this disgraceful and inconsistent law prohibiting such marriages was, quote, an invasion of one of the most inalienable rights of every man, namely the pursuit of happiness. Many later issues of the Liberator continued the call for the repeal of this legislation. And opposition from the southern states and even from other New England states and within the state legislature was fierce. Some Massachusetts legislators claimed that the ban against black and white marriages was not discriminatory because it applied equally to both races, and the punishment for both white and blacks was the same. So it's fine. People believed that this law recognized natural distinctions between the races, quote, which nothing but the insanity of fanaticism dares to arraign, end of quote. Others felt that it prevented a further deterioration of the white race, since mixed race descendants were an example of human de-evolutionary retrogression in the new language of Darwin. Later, LDS rhetoric would echo similar sentiments. On February 24, 1843, the Massachusetts state legislature voted to repeal the old law. Just 3.5 years later, Enoch and Matilda faced each other under God and pledged their marital vows in an extraordinary act of newly gained social and political freedom. Matilda, by the way, was actually 2 months pregnant at the time of her marriage, and some 6 months later, she gave birth to Enoch Lovejoy Lewis, Jr. Now, unfortunately for them, the president of the Eastern States Mission, a man named William I. Appleby, was proselytizing in the Boston Lowell area at the time of little Enoch's birth. A month after Enoch Jr. was born, Appleby visited the Lowell branch on May 19, 1847. He was shocked to discover that not only had a black man been ordained to the priesthood, which was Enoch's father, Walker Lewis,
and perhaps Enoch himself, and I believe so, but also that Enoch had married a white LDS woman. 2 weeks later, Appleby wrote a letter to Brigham Young informing him of this situation and wanting to know if the church indeed approved of blacks holding priesthood and marrying white women. His letter says, "At Lowell, I found a colored brother by the name of Lewis, a barber, an elder in the church, ordained some years ago by William Smith. This Lewis, I was informed, also has a son who is married to a white girl, and both members of the church there. Now, dear brother, I wish to know if this is the order of God or tolerated in this church, i.e., to ordain Negroes to the priesthood and allow amalgamation, which is intermarriage. If it is, I desire to know, as I have yet got to learn it." And then next slide. Almost a month later. Oh, wait. You jumped ahead. Sorry. Okay, so a month later, Appleby decided to investigate further and actually went to the Enoch Lewis home to witness their relationship. And that's where this is his journal entry here. He writes, "In looking for a brother, I called at a house, and a colored man resided there. I set myself down for a few minutes. For a few moments, presently in came quite a good-looking white woman, underlined and in quotation marks, about 22 years old, I should think, with blushing cheeks, and was introduced to me as the Negro's wife. An infant in a cradle near bore evidence of the fact. Oh, woman, thought I, where is thy shame? For indeed, I felt ashamed and disgusted when I was informed that they were both members of a..." I think he meant to write "our," and then he obliterated the letter there, "our church. Where is respect for thy family, thyself, for thy offspring, and above all, the law of God?" Note that in his earlier letter to Brigham Young, Appleby seemed perplexed and inquisitive, but after meeting the couple face to face, his emotions had grown much stronger, indeed into shame and disgust. I would postulate that the significant difference between the letter that he wrote to Young and his journal entry a month later is because upon actually meeting the couple, Appleby was struck by two things, and that's Matilda's beauty. It sounds like he's almost attracted to her. And more importantly, the blatant and public evidence of their private sexual intercourse, which was their baby. Also note here that Appleby refers to Matilda's lack of respect for her mixed-race offspring, but above all, to the law of God. Now, in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith reflected general lower-class white attitudes towards black-white marriage and said on January 2nd, 1843, "Had I anything to do with the Negro, I would confine them to their own species." And as proof of that belief, a year later, Joseph Smith, as Nauvoo's Justice of the Peace, fined two African-American men $25 and $5, respectively, for trying to marry white women. Otherwise, Joseph Smith's views specific to black-white marriage have not been recorded. Next slide. Now, Warner, a.k.a. William McCary, a runaway slave from Natchez, Mississippi, arrived in Nauvoo at the end of 1845, claiming to be part African and part American Indian, including being the lost son of the Choctaw tribal chief, Amasholi Tubi. But his Indian ancestry was merely a scam. McCary was baptized and then ordained an elder, allegedly. His real father was his own slave master, James McCary. Where did I go? Let's see. McCary was baptized and then ordained an elder by Orson Hyde about February 1846, as the rest of the Mormons abandoned Nauvoo and headed points westward. About this time, Hyde is reported to have also married McCary to a white sister at Nauvoo. The Strangites also heard a similar rumor, only they heard McCary was only Native American and not part African as well. This is a quote from the Voree Herald, where they said, "We are informed that Orson Hyde, before leaving the camp near Council Bluffs, has made a tool of an Indian whom he has baptized and ordained to go out among the churches and call himself a Lamanite prophet." This white sister who married the runaway slave, posing as an Afro-Indian, was none other than Lucille Ann Celesta Stanton Bassett, daughter of prominent Nauvoo State President Daniel Stanton. Her parents had been some of the first converts of the church living in the Kirtland area. When Lucille was about 15, she had become enthralled by the very first black Mormon, Black Pete, who lived in Kirtland. Along with her sisters, she became caught up in Black Pete's charismatic and revelatory experiences, such as catching letters from heaven. In the early days of Kirtland, when men were going on missions, the letters would float down from heaven. You would read it, you had enough time to write it down, and then the letter would disintegrate. And she participated in catching some of these letters. Here in Nauvoo, 15 years later, the now divorced woman and mother of three married another controversial Black Mormon as her second husband, the Warner McCary. Next slide. As I was revising this paper last week, sorry, Noel, it suddenly dawned on me that just as at this very critical moment when Brigham Young was confronted with Black male sexuality and seriously questioning Black participation in temple and priesthood in 1847, he himself was at the very center of a very public trial over his own marital improprieties back in Massachusetts. And this can only have had an effect upon his mind as he confronted Black-white marriages among the Mormons. A married Quaker woman named Augusta Adams Cobb had converted to Mormonism and fallen in love with Brigham Young while he was on one of his several missions to the Boston area. Augusta abandoned her husband and large family and moved to Nauvoo, where she was married to Young in 1843 as a plural wife. I think she was his third, but I'm not sure. This was contrary to the LDS practice in that church leaders forbade any man from marrying a woman who was not single, widowed, or divorced. Augusta's husband, Henry Cobb, was humiliated and deeply hurt by the actions of his wife and Brigham Young and began the long and expensive process of obtaining a legal divorce from Augusta by claiming that indeed his wife and Brigham Young were living in adultery, not just polygamy. Eventually, the case of Cobb versus Cobb reached the Massachusetts Supreme Court, where the greatest legal minds of the United States sat at that time. These were five brilliant men. The men on this court were great liberal progressives. They were all abolitionists, supporters of worker and union rights, proto-feminists. And their decisions were iconic and profoundly influenced American life for decades. The Supreme Court severely humiliated and castigated Young publicly for his marital deviance. And as you'll see, on November 24th, Judge Sumner Wilde decreed a full divorce after hearing all the evidence. It gives dates when Brigham Young and Augusta Adams had sex and enough. It's pretty wild. The legal documents are pretty amazing. The next slide, please. So the Supreme Court, in lieu of this, did Brigham Young turn and take out his frustrations on a group of what he considered inferiors, reduced to a very crass aphorism, crap runs downhill, I think, in this case. So here we have a list of early African-American priesthood holders and their wives, if any, before 1847. And Brigham Young certainly knew Joseph T. Ball and Walker Lewis and William McCary personally. And Elijah Abel really is the only one that we know of who married a woman of African descent. And I think this really bothered Brigham Young that, if we're going to allow these Black elders into the church and hold priesthood, why are they going after white women? So while all this was going on in Massachusetts with the Supreme Court, and then publicized nationally through the newspapers, here's what's going on at Winter Quarters. Brigham Young was already long aware of these men. Here in Nauvoo, Brigham Young told recently ordained Warner McCary that holding the priesthood had nothing to do with race. On March 26, 1847, Young told McCary that holding the priesthood, quote, had nothing to do with the blood, for from one blood has God made all flesh. We have to repent to gain what we have lost. So I emphasize that in March 1847, Young said that there basically was no priesthood ban at that time. We're all one blood. There aren't different races, and race isn't an issue in who gets it. It's repentance. But then by December of 1847, all of this has changed. as I noted earlier, the mission president, Appleby, wrote a report to Brigham Young about his discovery of Enoch Lewis's marriage to Matilda Webster. He mailed this report to Brigham Young with an address at Council Bluff, Iowa, where it was then forwarded to Winter Quarters, Nebraska, and it remained there, for Young was just settling in Utah. So the acting Mormon president did not receive the letter for some 6 months. Ironically, Appleby's letter, Brigham Young himself, and William I. Appleby all converged at Winter Quarters at the beginning of December 1847. And that's right when the Massachusetts Supreme Court made its decision at the end of November, and so this is just a week later. Here they are meeting in council at Winter Quarters. Young read Appleby's letter regarding the marriage of Enoch and Matilda Lewis and then immediately met with Appleby in person to ensure the accuracy of the details of the interracial marriage. As shown, by December 1847, things had significantly changed for Brigham Young. Warner McCary had come out in open rebellion against the church and had started his own version of Mormonism, including a highly sexualized sealing ceremony in which McCary was sealed to white women to the white women of his disciples by sleeping with them. In response to all this, Young called a meeting of the members of the 12 who were present at Winter Quarters and had Appleby appear to personally give an account. Here are Thomas Bullock's minutes of that meeting. He has tiny, tiny handwriting, and he writes like email. We do an email now. He uses the letter R for the word R, and all kinds of abbreviations and stuff. This is an exact transcription of what he wrote. So Brother Appleby relates William Smith ordained an elder. He's married a white girl, and they have a child. And then President Young says, if they were far away, if Enoch and Matilda were far away from the Gentiles, they would all ought to be killed. When they mingle seed, it is death to all. If a black man and white woman come to you and demand baptism, can you deny them? The law is their seed shall not be amalgamated. Mulattoes are like mules. They can't have children. But if they will be eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake, they may have a place in the temple. Young again says, the Lamanites are purely of the house of Israel, and it is a curse that is to be removed when the fullness of the gospel comes. Orson Hyde, quote, has taught that if girls marry the half-breeds, and I guess that means mixed-race men, they are throwing themselves away and becoming as one of them. And Brigham Young confirms that it's wrong for them to do so. And then he says the Potawatomis will not own a man who has the Negro blood in him. That is the reason why the Indians disowned the Negro prophet, referring to William McCary, who had moved on and was trying to proselyte among Indian tribes. So here, this really crucial meeting. I think this is the focus of where it all starts and comes from. We have the first LDS attempts at formulating a theology that prohibited black-white marriage. Next slide, please. And here's kind of a rundown of, or an overview of all the that I've uncovered here. It's prohibited and contrary to church doctrine from ancient times. It would lead to the annihilation of the human species since mixed-race children cannot reproduce. It and the reproduction of mixed-race children requires blood atonement. It's a great sin. The interracial marriage of Ham and Egyptus brought tainted black blood and its priesthood temple curse through the universal flood. Racial segregation is a necessary evil to prevent black-white marriage in mass and total genetic chaos of mixing the white and black races, leading to the complete loss of priesthood on the earth, the destruction of the LDS Church, and the loss of exaltation in the celestial kingdom for all of humanity. And then lastly, it is a virus and will spread contagiously. And so this is an overview of everything I've found. And you'll notice that a lot of it comes from Brigham Young's original statement. Most of what these items are start there with that meeting. this the idea, well, we'll start with, first with mixed race children can't reproduce. The idea that black and white mixed children cannot reproduce, just as mules cannot. And there's a lot of play on the word mulatto and mule, because they actually come from the same root. This was also brought up later in Utah. The juvenile instructor in 1868 said, in fact, we believe it to be a great sin in the eyes of our Father for a white person to marry a black one, and further, that it is proof of the mercy of God that no... Margaret?
Gosh darn it.
And further, that is proof of the mercy of a God that no such race appear is able to continue for many generations. And it was this idea was again reiterated by Mormon Bishop John M. Whitaker, who's actually a relative of mine, as late as 1913, after he held a private meeting with Booker T. Washington, when Washington spoke at the University of Utah. I won't get into that. I've cut that out to make this shorter. We'll now move on to blood atonement. In 1847, with the Enoch and Matilda Lewis case, Young first introduced the idea that black-white marriage merited capital punishment, promising that if the Lewises lived far away from the Gentiles, they would be killed. When Enoch's father, Walker Lewis, was wintering in Salt Lake City in 1851 and 1852, Brigham Young pointedly had the legislature pass a law forbidding not marriage between blacks and whites, but all sex between blacks and whites. In getting the all-LDS territorial legislature to pass this statute in February 1852, Young told the legislature, quote, "And if any man mingles his seed with the seed of Cain, the only way he could get rid of it or have salvation would be to come forward and have his head cut off and spill his blood upon the ground. It would also take the life of his children." Brigham Young again affirmed blood atonement on March 8, 1863, which is right in the midst of the Civil War. He says, "Shall I tell you the law of God in regard to the African race? If the white man who belongs to the chosen seed mixes his blood with the seed of Cain, the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot, and this will always be so." In 1897, George Buchanan of the First Presidency said in the meeting of the 12 that, quote, he had understood President Taylor to say that a man who had the priesthood who would marry a woman of the cursed seed, that if the law of the Lord were administered upon him, he would be killed and his offspring, for the reason that the Lord had determined that the seed of Cain should not receive the priesthood in the flesh. And this was the penalty put upon Cain, because if he had received the priesthood, the seed of the murderer would get ahead of the seed of Abel, who was murdered. Now, Thomas Coleman was a slave brought to Utah, who then converted to Mormonism, and he was ritually murdered on December 10, 1866, allegedly for courting white women, or a white woman. After putting together all the known, this is a quote from the Salt Lake Daily Telegraph that basically talks about a report on Thomas Coleman's death. You'll see that we found that his right breast was cut and his throat, and this all fails to mention that he was also castrated, and it was all with his own Bowie knife. So it appears to be sort of temple-related ritualistic killing. And then pinned to his body, you'll see at the bottom, the murderer is left a large cardboard sign that says, "Notice to all niggers, take warning, leave white women alone." Now, but this isn't what it seems to be. My theory. After putting together all the known pieces and closely examining all the forensic evidence in this case, and there's a lot of it, I theorized in my biography of Thomas Coleman that I gave at the Mormon History Association in 2008 that Coleman was murdered not because of sexual advances he'd made towards white women, but because he was an eyewitness to the political assassination of Dr. John King Robinson in October of 1868. The non-Mormon doctor was murdered by Mormon vigilantes led by Salt Lake Police Chief Andrew H. Burt and at least two of his police underlings in the all-Mormon department. When Coleman was on the verge of telling federal investigators that he had seen Burt and his men murder Robinson in the streets of Salt Lake, I think Bird and his men then murdered the eyewitness, Thomas Coleman. I believe the police used almost identical tactics in both murders, but they were very sloppy the first time when they murdered Dr. Robinson because they left an eyewitness. They were more careful the second go-around, and then to cover up their tracks, they made Coleman's murder look as if an irate white father or brother and other concerned parties had taken Brigham Young's blood-atoning justice into their own hands to keep white womanhood safe from black male sexuality, and they got away with it. All right, now we move to the doctrine of Hammon Aegyptus. The LDS archetype for black-white marriage was, of course, Hammon Aegyptus. In Mormon mythos, a woman named Aegyptus was a descendant of Cain and bore his curse by being black. Before the flood, Noah's son Ham married Aegyptus, and thus black-skinned and cursed people were preserved on Noah's ark. Their interracial daughter, also named Aegyptus, became the wife of a man named Pharaoh, and he was the first ruler of Egypt, with the land named after his wife and mother-in-law. As John Taylor said on August 28, 1881, after the flood, we are told that the curse had been pronounced upon Cain was continued through Ham's wife, as he had married a wife of that seed. And why did it pass through the flood? Because it was necessary that the devil should have a representation upon the earth, as well as God. Just 3 months after Brown versus Board of Education desegregated public schools across the nation in May 1954, Marky Peterson gave arguably the most racist speech in LDS history at BYU to the college religion instructors, called Race Problems as They Affect the Church. This is not the quote yet. Hold on a second. In this talk, he linked the priesthood ban with prohibiting intermarriage with black people. He said, "What is our policy in regard to intermarriage? As to the Negro, of course, there is only one possible answer. We must not intermarry with the Negro. Why? If I were to marry a Negro woman and have children by her, my children would all be cursed as to the priesthood. And do I want my children cursed as to the priesthood? If there is one drop of Negro blood in my children, as I have read to you, they receive the curse. There isn't any argument, therefore, as to the intermarriage of the Negro, is there? As to intermarriage with the Negro, is there?" And then, taking his argument to the utmost extreme, Peterson reasoned, "There are 50 million Negroes in the United States. If they were to achieve complete absorption into the white race, think what that would do. With 50 million Negroes intermarried with us, where would the priesthood be? Who would hold it in all of America? Think what that would do to the work of the church." Peterson apparently assumed that all 50 million black U.S. citizens in 1954 actually wanted to marry white people, and that 50 million white U.S. citizens wanted to marry blacks. This slide. Earlier in his speech, Peterson said, "The Negro is not just seeking the opportunity of sitting down in a cafe where white people sit. He isn't just trying to ride on the same streetcar or on the Pullman car. It appears that the Negro seeks absorption with the white race. He will not be satisfied until he achieves it by intermarriage. That is the objective, and we must face it. Remember the little statement that they used to say about sin: first we pity, then endure, then embrace." But Peterson deeply feared desegregation as the top of a slippery slope that would lead to the utter absorption of black into white and white into black, a genetically chaotic mess and leaving the world unworthy of priesthood and temple ordinances. Allowing blacks and whites to mix socially in public, whether on the bus or in schools or in a soda pop counter, could only lead America into a downward spiral. Public acts of sociality would lead to private acts of friendship, becoming then conducive to private acts of love, desire, and commitment, and culminating in public acts of marriage and then private acts of black-white mingling through sex. It seems to me that Peterson here really used the priesthood and temple ban as a justification for his own racism. Then next slide, please. J. Reuben Clark of the First Presidency spoke at a Young Women's Mutual Improvement Association conference in June 1846 about interracial marriage. "We should hate nobody. And having said that, I wish to urge a word of caution, particularly to you young girls. It is sought today in certain quarters to break down all race prejudice And at the end of the road, which they urged that this, which they who urged this see, is intermarriage. That is what it finally comes to. Now, you should hate nobody. You should give to every man and every woman, no matter what the color of his skin or his or her skin may be, full civil rights. You should treat them as brothers and sisters. But, of course, there's the but. Do not ever let that wicked virus into your systems that brotherhood either permits or entitles you to mix races which are inconsistent. In 1947, a Mormon in California named Virgil Spongberg wrote to the First Presidency questioning whether, quote, we as Latter-day Saints are required to associate with the Negroes or talk the gospel to them. The First Presidency, which consisted of George Albert Smith, J. Reuben Clark, and David O. McKay, responded by warning against the slippery slope of desegregation. They said, no special effort has ever been made to proselyte among the Negro race, and social intercourse between the whites and Negroes should certainly not be encouraged because of leading to intermarriage, which the Lord has forbidden. This move, which has now received some popular approval of trying to break down social barriers between the whites and the blacks, is one that should not be encouraged because inevitably it means the mixing of the races if carried to its logical conclusion, end of quote. 2 months later, they reaffirmed this in a letter to Dr. Lowry Nelson, an LDS professor of sociology. They said, quote, the intermarriage of the Negro and white races is a concept which has heretofore been most repugnant to most normal-minded people from the ancient patriarchs till now, end of quote. In 1954, in that same speech that Peterson made, he said, I think the Lord segregated the Negro, and who is man to change that segregation? Although the church said out one side of its mouth that African Americans deserved full equal civil rights, this, however, did not include the right to marry the person of their choice. They denied the civil right for blacks to marry whites or whites to marry blacks on biological and other grounds, and discouraged all social intercourse between the two races in order to prevent such marriages. In 1954, the First Presidency directed their secretary, Joseph Anderson, to respond to a correspondent, quote, the church is opposed on biological and other grounds to intermarriage between whites and Negroes, and it discourages all social relationships and association between the races as among its members that might lead to such marriages. The presidency also believed that all men, without regard to race or color, were entitled to, quote, full civil rights and liberties, social, economic, and political, as provided in the Constitution and laws, end of quote. Yet they remained firmly against the right for them to marry the person of their choice if they were of another race. John L. Lund, an LDS author and teacher, clarified Brigham Young's denunciation of black-white marriage in 1967 after quoting Young's statement about the penalty under the law of God is death on the spot, and that this will always be so. Lund wrote, quote, the reason that one would lose his blessings by marrying a Negro is due to the restriction placed upon them. No person having the least particle of Negro blood can hold the priesthood. It does not matter if they are 1/6 or 106th, the curse of no priesthood is still the same. If an individual who is entitled to the priesthood marries a Negro, the Lord has decreed that only spirits who are not eligible for the priesthood will come to that marriage as children. To intermarry with a Negro is to forfeit a nation of priesthood holders. And then Bruce R. McConkie, bless his heart, in Mormon Doctrine, spoke about, sorry, he spoke about the fact that caste systems were divinely decreed to keep the races apart. He, quote, in a broad general sense, caste systems have their root and origin in the gospel itself, and when they operate according to the divine decree, the resultant restrictions and segregation are right and proper and have the approval of the Lord. To illustrate, Cain, Ham, and the whole Negro race have been cursed with a black skin, the mark of Cain, so they can be identified as a caste apart, a people with whom the other descendants of Adam should not intermarry, end of quote. Okay, but now, so that's the theory. That's what's being taught. Now let's talk about what actually happened in the real lives of people.
15 minutes.
For you?
Well, yeah, just left in the whole session.
Just 15 minutes?
Yeah, we got 15 minutes left.
Oh,
sorry,
goodness.
I'd be the bad guy, being the chair as well as the commentator for both selfies.
That's all right. I was going to share with you all kinds of people who...
An important part of your paper, if you could summarize a little bit about these OVS people. I thought that was really one of the most important
things. Doesn't it say that it ends at 11:10?
Does it what? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we're okay. Because I thought it was only an hour, because I know the last one.
We have an hour now.
We're good. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Move on.
I thought I had searched for this to get it down.
It was like the previous session we only had an hour.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So we now turn to what LDS teachers taught, from what they taught to what happened. Basically, during the Victorian period, several prominent LDS people married light-skinned spouses of African descent, and the results were very mixed and contradictory. Most often, nothing happened, and these people held either priesthood or were endowed and sealed in the temples. Some were not. Some were allowed to, but their children were not. In Salt Lake City in 1863, English convert Nathan Meads married his first wife, Rebecca Henrietta Foskey, who was 1/4 African-American. At this time in Utah history, black-white marriages were not illegal, but their sexual relations were, and they were punishable by a severe fine. Somehow this couple avoided any legal prosecution and had several children. I have not yet been able to discover if their marriage was simply civil or if it was a temple sealing, but their marriage resulted in some 8 children, all of whom were very dark-complexioned. And then their children went on to marry into prominent LDS families and were all sealed and endowed. Those who made it to adulthood did marry, and none were denied priesthood, although their African ancestry was widely known. In 1885, the Nathan Meads family came to the attention of President John Taylor when Taylor's son, who was the first counselor in the Salt Lake State, Joseph E. Taylor, wrote to him about another case of black-white marriage. And in this second case, an LDS convert named Mary Bowditch from the Isle of Guernsey off the coast of France, she had married an African-American man named James Preston Berry in Utah around 1864. And by this black man, she had 2 daughters, Laura Jane and Mary J. Berry. The interracial marriage ended, and Mary Bowditch then married another husband who was white named Smith, and she had a son by him. Now, Mary Bowditch's mixed-race daughter, Laura Jane Berry, came to President John Taylor's attention when, in July 1885, she was courting Hiram B. Barton, the youngest son of a prominent LDS family in the Salt Lake 14th Ward. Hiram Barton, already married once, wished to have Laura Berry be his polygamous wife. But as Joseph E. Taylor wrote to his father in 85, the question of his jeopardizing his future by such an alliance has caused a halt. End of quote. Joseph Taylor added that Laura Berry, quote, now desires to press her claim to privileges that others who are tainted with that blood have received, end of quote. And during an interview with Joseph Taylor, Laura Berry cited the example of the aforementioned Nathan Meads with his mixed-race wife and all their children having married into Mormon families and being endowed and receiving priesthood. Laura Berry also cited another example of the elder sister of a Mrs. Jones of Logan, but I've been able to discover who this was. There aren't many clues, and the name Jones is too common. Apparently, Mrs. Jones's elder sister had married a black man, but then she went on to receive her endowments. Joseph Taylor, in describing the Nathan Meads case to his father, wrote, quote, Brother Meads is a white man. He married his wife many years ago. She was a quadroon and died some 3 years ago. Their children are all very dark, and the oldest girl is married to a white man, who is Hiram Barton. So then after citing these examples to his church president father, Joseph Taylor asked, quote, Can you give Laura Berry any privileges of a life character? The girl is very pretty and quite white and would not be suspected of having tainted blood in her veins unless her parentage was known, end of quote. I do not have a reply from President John Taylor, but that same month, Laura Berry polygamously married Hiram Barton, and they had a large family together who are all apparently remained faithful Mormons. So John Taylor must have approved of this interracial marriage in the temple. The First Presidency was confronted with another case in 1895 when, quote, a white sister who married a Negro man entreated for permission to receive her ordinances, end of quote. Franklin D. Richards, who was present, wrote only in his journal, but she was refused. A month later, in September 1895, Franklin Richards again recorded in his journal a case that's so similar, I think it refers to that first case. And this involved none other than Mary Bowditch herself, the white mother of Laura Berry. Now that her mixed-race daughter had married a good Mormon man, and she herself had married a white man, Mary Bowditch wished to be endowed and sealed to her new husband and to their white son. However, as a penalty for having previously married a black man, she was denied entrance into the temple. 2 years later, one of the most fascinating cases regarding black-white marriage and its varied, even wildly contradictory consequences came before the First Presidency in Quorum of the Twelve. A young Mormon named John Taylor Church, having just turned 21 in January 1900, received his patriarchal blessing in Oasis, Utah in February of 1900 under the hands of Patriarch John Ashman. John Taylor Church was told in his patriarchal blessing that he was of the lineage of Ephraim, would receive the priesthood, and fulfill an LDS mission. The only problem was John Taylor Church's mother was mulatto. And not just mulatto, but a former Texas slave, or Tennessee slave. Having been promised the priesthood and the mission call, neighbors of the Church family began to question, quote, the right of this party to hold the priesthood, some holding that he might do so provided that the white blood predominates over the black blood, end quote. The case was then brought before President Lorenzo Snow in the Quorum of the Twelve on March 1, 1900, just 2 weeks after the controversial blessing was given. A letter was read to the church leaders from Ira Hinckley explaining the controversy that was brewing in Millard County. Again, George Q. Cannon was the lead in the discussions of race, this time quoting things that Joseph Smith never actually said. Most were actually Brigham Young's words that Cannon attributed to Smith. John Taylor Church, despite the promise in his blessing, was denied permission to receive the priesthood, to perform temple ordinances, and to go on a mission. He briefly apostatized from the church and later became the mayor of Eureka, Utah, although years later he did return to the church. But this story isn't over. In fact, it's barely begun. His mother, Harriet Elnora Burkett Church, was born a slave in 1843 in Shady Grove, Tennessee. Sometime before 1850, little Harriet was purchased by Thomas Henry Church, a young man who had just married and started his own family. Around 1858, when Harriet was only 15, Thomas H. Church had sexual relations with his slave, Harriet, and she became pregnant with a daughter who was named Laura. Not Laura Berry, another Laura. Thomas's white wife, Nancy Bryan Church, died 3 years later in 1861. And during the Civil War, Thomas Church served the Confederate Army as a second lieutenant in the Cavalry Battalion. Upon his return to Maury County, Tennessee, after the war, Thomas Church married his slave girl, Harriet Elnora Burkett, and acknowledged her daughter as his own. And I say married in quotations because, in fact, miscegenation was illegal in Tennessee. The former slave master and slave then formally began a large mixed-race family of what it would eventually be 11 children. Thomas H. Church, his slave now wife, and his children converted to Mormonism in Tennessee about 1877 due to the fact that Thomas's older brother, Hayden Church, had already converted decades earlier, moved to Nauvoo in the 1840s, and then on to Utah. I've corresponded with two LDS descendants of Thomas Church and his former slave, Harriet Burkett, and neither of them knew anything about Harriet's biography prior to arriving in Utah. They had no idea that she had been a slave or was of African descent. To my utter surprise, they informed me that in 1903, 3 years after her son had been denied the priesthood, she was allowed to be endowed and sealed in the temple. And that this is really significant because this is the first case that I know of an ex-slave entering a temple. Where did I got lost in my notes? Oh shoot! Da-da-da-da. This is the only case of a black-white ceiling being officiated in an LDS temple prior to 1978, like totally open. I think it is significant that as a white man and a black woman, instead of vice versa, this ceiling maintains strict patriarchal notions of male masterhood and female servitude. It is also my belief that Harriet Church is the only former slave, male or female, ever to be endowed and sealed in an LDS temple. Oddly, five of their children were allowed to were allowed to participate in temple ritual, but the other six were not allowed to. It was just luck of the draw, I guess. Again, curiously, in January 1902, a year before Thomas and Harriet Church were sealed in the temple, another case came before the First Presidency and the Council of the Twelve. Rutger Clausen, in visiting the severe Utah stake, had met with a woman who was about to marry into a local Richfield family. Her fiancé was 1/8 black through his mother, and this bride-to-be asked Clausen, quote, if the fact of his having inherited Negro blood would be a bar to his receiving the priesthood and endowments, end of quote. Although the unnamed woman did not ask, apparently she intended to be sealed interracially to him as well. Clausen did not have a response for her and took her question to his colleagues. In response, President Joseph F. Smith said, quote, Presidents Young and Taylor were emphatic in denying to any person receiving the priesthood or endowments who had Negro blood in their veins. John Henry Smith replied, it seemed to him that persons in whose veins white blood predominated should not be barred from the temple. So if you're at least 51% white, it was okay. Joseph F. Smith's final opinion was, quote, in all cases where the blood of Cain showed itself, however slight, the line should be drawn there. But where children of tainted parents were found to be pure Ephraimites, they might be admitted to the temple. Rutger Clausen informed the LDS Council that this was an answer to his question, and he was satisfied with that. And then in 1947, an extreme of sort was reached when the quorum upheld a decision by John Widso denying a temple recommend to a sister having 1/32nd of Negro blood in her. That means she had one black great-great-great-great-grandparent. Widso did question, quote, whether in such cases the individual might be recommended to the temple for marriage, end of quote, but the policy prevailed and she received no temple recommend. And so that's sort of my overview of what happened in real lives, and it was very contradictory, as you can see. And we now turn to miscegenation in the Deseret News. If you'll put up the next slide, please. I'm not going to go through a lot of this. This is just a listing of some of the articles that appeared in the Deseret News from 1864 to 1910. And the bold ones are some of the more important ones. And then the two most important ones I'm going to deal with. Well, actually, there's one in the Deseret News that I want to deal with. And then there's an ad in the Salt Lake Herald, which was also an LDS newspaper, but it was the sort of the political, radical LDS paper. The Deseret News was sort of very staid and conservative, whereas the Herald was allowed to pretty much do whatever they wanted and say whatever they wanted. But I'm still going through the Herald to examine what they said on miscegenation, and I haven't produced them all, but I found this ad that I just have to show you because it's crazy. But back to the Deseret News. George Q. Cannon, counselor in the First Presidency, who has already made his anti-miscegenation views quite clear, he also helped to establish race-based policies for the church. He wrote a special editorial for the Deseret News in 1893, decrying miscegenation and supporting racial eugenics, and especially Celto-Germanic supremacy, and then parental involvement in choosing spouses for LDS youth in order to maintain racial purity. this talk that, or this editorial that Cannon wrote for the Deseret News, it's just called An Ex-Editor's Saturday Talk. And I'm just, it's really long, I'm only going to quote part of it. A friend who is a very prominent man in public life remarked to me the other day that one of the great questions which was facing itself upon the attention of thinking men concerning the future of the Republic is the conflict of races. In the South, the white and colored elements are brought in close proximity to each other and with bad results. In the northern states, he said, there was a great influx of low foreign element which was having a bad effect upon the character of the population and was likely to contribute to the degradation of the Caucasian type. He deplored the tendency there... I've made a mistake. Let's see. He deplored the tendency that there was in many quarters to look with toleration and in some instances with encouragement upon miscegenation. In the South, the colored people were increasing very rapidly, and the admixture of the white blood with them was hybridizing the race and gradually destroying the higher type of race. The people of Utah are to be congratulated upon their position. The purity of the Caucasian race is more likely to be preserved in our territory than in any other portion of the United States. In the first place, there is a well-founded dislike to intermarriage or intimate association with inferior races. End of quote. Next slide, please. This is the ad from the Salt Lake Herald that just kills me. The direct effect of miscegenation on innocent women and babies. This is a subject about which people have thought it improper to talk or even think. The result is shown in figures. To it is due 65% of the surgical operations on good women and one-third of all blindness in babies. It is 10 times as contagious as leprosy and causes more deaths than tuberculosis. And it thrives only because it is tabooed in speech. I mean, it's an ad for another magazine, of course. It's called Pearson's, but I just... that they're advertising this to a Mormon population says a lot, I think. Brigham Young, now we're going to turn from the newspaper articles to anti-miscegenation in Utah law. Back to 1852, Brigham Young addressed the territorial legislature to push through a law that not only legalized slavery, but also made black-white sexual relations illegal. As recorded by Wilford Woodruff in his journal, Young first explained to the legislature about Cain's murder of Abel and the subsequent curse. God then marked Cain with black skin so all would see the curse and his descendants would all be likewise cursed and marked. Young then explained, quote, any man having one drop of the seed of Cain in him cannot hold the priesthood, and if no other prophet ever before spake it, I will say it now in the name of Jesus Christ. I know it is true and they know it. End of quote. Young then addressed intermarriage with the seed of Cain, and he said, quote, let me consent today to mingle my seed with the seed of Cain. It would bring the same priesthood curse upon me and it would upon any man. If any man mingles his seed with the seed of Cain, the only way he could get rid of it or have salvation would be to come forward and have his head cut off and spill his blood on the ground. It would also take the life of his children. Whenever the seed of Judah mingled with the seed of Cain, they lose their priesthood and all blessings. As an example, let the presidency, 12, 70s, high priests, bishops, and all the authorities say now, we will all go and mingle with the seed of Cain, and they may have all the privilege they want. We lift our hands to heaven in support of this. If we were to do that at that moment, we'd lose the priesthood and all blessings, and we would not be redeemed until Cain was redeemed. I will never admit of this for a moment. End of quote. Thus, marriage, sexual intercourse, and reproduction between the chosen seed and the cursed seed bore eternal consequences of such a heinous nature that the only way to expiate for this would be for the white person to voluntarily come forward and be ritually killed by his priesthood superiors in an act of blood atonement, along with his or her mixed-race priesthood, or mixed-race children. Young ended his speech by declaring that blacks were, by their very nature, suited to serve, while whites were given the role of ruler. Preventing marriage between whites and blacks preserved this divine social order and prevented the devil from ruling over the righteous by gaining power through mixed-race children. Young said, quote, The devil would like to rule part of the time, but I am determined he shall not rule at all, and Negroes shall not rule us. We must guard against all evil. And the quote. A month later, again addressing the legislature on the topic of divine slavery, on Cain and the natural right of whites to rule and blacks to serve, and upon the blood atonement for black-white marriages, Young said, "Were the children of God to mingle their seed with the seed of Cain, they would not only bring the curse of being deprived of the power of the priesthood upon themselves, but they entail it upon their children after them, and they cannot get rid of it. If a man in an unguarded moment should commit such a transgression, if he should walk up and say, 'Cut off my head,' and we then kill man, woman, and child, it would do a great deal towards atoning for their sin. Would this be to curse them? No, it would be a great blessing to them. It would do them good that they might be saved with their brethren. A man would shudder should they hear us talk about killing folk, but it is one of the greatest blessings to some to kill them, although the true principles of it are not understood." Young's law, of course, unanimously passed the all-general authority legislature. It is one of the few state or territorial laws in the history of the United States to prohibit interracial sex instead of marriage. Section 4 of the legal code says that if any master or mistress shall have sexual or carnal intercourse with his or her servant or servants of the African race, he shall forfeit them. And basically the slave then becomes property of the territory. And if any white person shall be guilty of sexual intercourse with any one of the African race, they shall be subject on conviction thereof to a fine of not exceeding $1,000. In 1852 in Utah, $1,000. Not less than $500 to the use of the territory, and imprisonment not exceeding 3 years. Now, as I said, this was a very rare law. I think it was Tennessee and Alabama were the only other two that prohibited sex. During John Taylor's presidency, Utah's territorial legislature passed an anti-miscegenation law prohibiting marriages between a Negro or a Mongolian and a white person, and this was passed in March 1888. So that's when actually interracial marriage became illegal, was in 88. Then in 1961, the Utah chapter of the ACLU, spurred on by support from an activist Salt Lake County clerk and the county attorney's office, who felt that the laws were unjust and wanted to see them challenged in court, tried to find mixed race couples in Utah to sue the state and repeal the law, but none of them wanted the publicity. Finally, Utah's legislature on its own rescinded the state's anti-miscegenation law in April 1963. And then in 1978, with the removal of the priesthood ban by Spencer Kimball, any justification for banning black-white marriages within LDS temples ended. In researching this paper, when coming across the statements and theological arguments that LDS leaders made against black-white marriage, most of the time I was reminded of just how similar, even identical, these sounded to my ears in relation to the arguments now presented by the LDS leaders against same-sex marriage. Currently, the LDS Church fully accepts black-white civil marriages and has performed black-white sealings in temples for more than 30 years, and the feared and promised destruction of humanity has not taken place. What was once considered a dire sin and shameful practice, utterly prohibited because of the enormous social, political, spiritual, and soteriological consequences for all humanity, has now been embraced, accepted, and celebrated by the faithful. With this clear and near-perfect precedent set, I can only demand to know how soon before the LDS leaders will allow same-sex couples the free agency to marry just civilly those whom we love. Thank you.
Well, I should mention that this paper in certain places was significantly different from what version I received. There was the addition of material, deletion of material, whatever, but I'm going to go along. And it was pretty much the way that he gave it to me. And so I think most of my comments do apply, and I will try to get these, sum these up in 10 minutes or less, so that'll leave about 10 minutes for you to be able to ask questions and make comments. And I guess the bottom line is I find Connell's paper, as he presented today, in summary, ambitious, multifaceted, and engaging. It came across in all three of those ways to me, and I hope it came across to you in those ways too. And I find that at least in four different aspects of this wide-ranging presentation, Connell reflects the careful, prodigious research that has become a hallmark of his work. I mean, he has moved far and away beyond the research that I have done, Armin Moss has done, Lester L. Bush has done, and he's just, as I mentioned in introducing him, that further vindicates that observation that I made at the beginning. I just want to give four or five examples in which this indeed was the case in some of the things he covered in the paper. The first example would be his analysis and coverage of the significance of the interracial marriage of Enoch Lovejoy Lewis to Mary Matilda Webster. And he carefully places this event within the context of the recent repeal of Massachusetts' long-standing law prohibiting interracial marriage. I thought that was really nice, the way that he was able to do that. So in a way, they were very much pioneering people, yes, in this regard. And I like the contextual way in which he put that in there. And of course, Enoch Lewis's significance was not just in this interracial marriage, but in the fact that he was apparently also a priesthood holder himself, although the evidence of that isn't completely solid, definitive. Right. It's still not, but it's pretty definitive that his father, Walker Lewis, was a priesthood holder, and he, along with the list of people that Connell put on the slide or on the overhead, shows that Joseph Smith had a much more liberal, a much more open policy in allowing for the ordination of blacks in the early church. And it appears that more and more of these people are coming up all the time. I mean, what is the count up to? We're up to at least six or seven now. And so I think that underscores the significance of Enoch Lewis and the fact that he mentioned that a number of these people were involved in interracial activity. The only one that married a black woman was Elijah Abel. Now, the second significant topic, a second way that I found highlighted this paper, was his discussion of Werner or William McCary. McCary was an extremely pivotal figure. And, of course, Connell is building on the pioneering work done by UCLA anthropology professor Patrick Polk. Yes. Patrick Polk is at work currently on a book-length study dealing with William McCary. He has come up with a whole wealth of information about this once obscure, very charismatic, colorful, no pun intended, individual that had a profound impact on early Mormonism and was involved in an interracial marriage of his own, performed by none other, it appears, than Orson Hyde, who Orson Hyde later on became one of the most dogmatic spokesmen against black people, against pro-slavery, anti-black, and everything else. I mean, if you want to talk about a conflicted personality, you have to just look at Orson Hyde. I mean, even the name Orson Hyde, he sounds like something out of something that make a horror movie or something like that. Maybe it sounds kind of horrific, but I won't go there. I did, though. that was the and of course the whole situation of William McCary had a direct influence, as Connell has pointed out, in pushing Brigham Young to that critical December meeting. And that document, I mean, I don't know where he picked up that document. That's a fantastic document from the Thomas Bullock
I stole diary. It out of the vault. No, I'm just kidding.
True confessions here today. But, I mean, that is an incredible document on several different levels. If you closely analyze the statements that were made, it touches on a myriad of justification for black priesthood denial and for the subordination of black people within the church. And so that really stood out as a significant finding. And of course, all of the ethos that developed, the what I call the emerging Mormon ethos. I wrote these out, but now I'm paraphrasing. But I'll quote this one: the emerging Mormon ethos of prohibiting the theology that prohibited black-white intermarriage included amongst its tenets call for racial segregation, promotion of the belief that black-white marriage would lead to the annihilation of the human race, and a call for blood atonement for all those in violation of this so-called commandment of God. I mean, you got that in that meeting, that call for blood atonement comes out as early as December 1847. All of this was given scriptural legitimacy through references to the recently published Book of Abraham. You know, one thing that you might have been clear in your paper and pointing out is that this Ham Egyptus thing is directly from the Book of Abraham.
Yes.
And of course, the Book of Abraham had been recently published in Nauvoo in the Times and Seasons, and was destined to become a part of the Pearl of Great Price, which is eventually canonized as Holy Scripture in 1880. But even more enlightening from my perspective is a third aspect of Connell's paper. And that is that's where he discusses anti-miscegenation dogma meeting reality and how that affected the lives of those real people, to quote Connell. And I found these case studies to be both riveting and poignant all at the same time. This was particularly the case with the situation of Hiram B. Barton, who polygamously married a mixed-race woman, Laura Barry, with the apparent approval of then-LDS President John Taylor. And it's interesting, in the words of the Mormon authorities considering the case, the woman just described as, quote, very pretty and quite white and would not be suspected as having tainted blood in her veins unless her parentage was known. And Barry herself was persistent in pressing her claims, and I think this is also an evocative quote, is a claim to privilege that others who were tainted with black African blood have received. So she was well aware, as Connell mentions, that this was not a unique situation with her. This was being done in numerous cases involving blacks and people with African American blood throughout the church in Utah during the pioneer period. And then also striking is the case of Harriet Elnora Burchett, who along, you know, she's the former slave of the master, where they had 11 children. And as he pointed out, that this case is I think significant on two levels. It's the first, it's the only apparent case of a black-white sealing being officiated in the LDS temple prior to 1978, particularly in the case, as he said, where the woman is African-American.
Right.
Black and the man is white, kind of turning on his head this whole patriarchal thing. I thought that was an interesting statement. He didn't make that in the original paper, but he made it in the paper that he gave me. But the other thing is that she's the only known ex-slave to have been sealed in the temple too, and that has interesting theological significances as well. And this whole thing is so ironic, especially when you think of you look at the poignant cases that Margaret Young, and it's pointed out in the movie and in her own research, in her own fantastic trilogy of books on that she's done, where you have people like Samuel Chambers, J. Manning James, and priesthood holders like Walker Lewis and Elijah Abel repeatedly admonishing for permission to get their endowments and being turned away, being denied over and over and over again. It just underscores that ironic inconsistency. Well, the fourth section of Connell's paper that I find engaging was the section miscegenation denounced in the Deseret News. Although I like to have seen a little bit more fleshing out and development there. That came across a little bit choppy.
I had to cut something out. One of the kids had to go.
Yeah. A lot of the cutting room floor, yeah. I realize. But I think there could be a lot more analysis done. I think in and of itself that could be developed and fleshed out even more. Particularly evocative is when he quotes George Q. Cannon. Good old George Buchanan. He's one of those people that you kind of love to hate. I mean, he's sort of like Boyd K. Packer, another one of Connell's favorites. Anyway, we won't go there, but we already did. Again.
Bless your heart.
I'm getting wound up here. That's the problem with getting older, and you get more crotchety as you get older. Anyway, Cannon, he admonishes his Latter-day Saints to maintain racial purity. Supporting the racial eugenics and white, the idea of white superiority, such doctrines, unfortunately, were far from unique. I need to mention this here. Were far from unique to Mormonism or even American society during the late 19th century. As you well, those of you who are students of American history well know, this was a time where American race relations were at their historic low point. The nadir of race relations, as one historian has termed it. And it was also a time when there was a peak, a high point, of black lynchings throughout the postbellum South. But honestly, such concepts were not unique to America, but were very much in vogue in Western Europe, where racial eugenics and theories of Nordic racial superiority foreshadowed the pernicious racist theories of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. I've read a number of articles on this, and it's really eerie almost to read this, that this is the same thing they were saying not only in the Mormon Church, not only in American society, but here it was almost like a virus that was throughout the Western world during the late 19th, early 20th centuries. We have to keep in mind that broader, I think, historical context. In summary, each of the four sections that I've discussed bring forth new information, provide fresh insights on the controversial topic of Mormon attitudes and practices involving black-white racial intermixture. Each is ideal for at least a scholarly article, if not a book-length study in and of itself. All of this, I think, underscores the persistent, what I would call the persistent presence of the black issue within Mormonism, wherein church leaders on all levels throughout the 19th and well into the 20th century were compelled to confront this issue. The so-called, what I would call, the Mormon dilemma of race became particularly pervasive in the period after 1945 and throughout the 1960s. A fact carefully documented in the correspondence and papers of David O. McKay, contained in the Gregory Prince papers, housed in the Special Collections Library of the University of Utah. I've had a chance to go through and carefully examine these. It's just really incredible that how the issues of race and place of blacks and temple endowments, all this comes up repeatedly again and again and again throughout the post World War II period, all the way down to the time of the death of David O. McKay. You can understand why he was wrestling with this issue and why church leaders were wrestling with the issue the way they were. It was much more evident than we were led to believe on the outside, even though bits and pieces of it seeped into the public record. I would urge Connell to look at those things. They're readily available, they're open, and that would, I think, it would bolster and even give a further texture to what you've been doing in your research and writing. And I thank Connell for an excellent job.
Thank you.
I have questions. Let's see. Go ahead, Bob.
The last statement that I appeared to be a punchline, I couldn't get it. I couldn't read what was up there because it wasn't up long enough.
Oh.
So it appeared to me there was a question of why hasn't the church changed? I know two people in my ward, a black and a white in each case, are married in the temple and are functioning in our ward. What was the question then?
Oh, but the question, can you put the last slide back up? The black white ceilings are now allowed. This was once considered profoundly sinful and contrary to God's divine law, and now that's changed. So my question is, if that can happen, that's a precedent for same-sex marriages to now be allowed to be legalized, and I want to know how long it's going to take the church.
Okay.
Right, totally different. Yeah. But thank you.
Yeah. Well, you could also add maybe allowing for the sanctioning of polygamy. I mean, you know, for what the polygamous marriage. I mean, people in the fundamentalist community. I know I've had interaction with people in the Mormon fundamentalist community, and they make the same arguments as the gay community makes.
Yes.
Two related questions. First, I look forward to this being published. This is wonderful.
Thank you.
One, we know that Walker Lewis did go to Utah. We also know he went back to Lowell, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Was this a direct result of the 1852 Brigham Young anti-desegregation law?
Can we stop right there? I need to repeat your question so it gets recorded.
Please do.
Okay, so your question is, we know Walker Lewis came to Utah in the winter of 1851-52, and that he then returned to Lowell, Massachusetts. And your question is, was that because of the...
The result of the 1852 anti-miscegenation law that was passed.
Right. Did he return because of the 1852 territorial law? I mean, I've postulated that yes, that is what happened. But Walker Lewis, when he was in Lowell, Massachusetts, he entertained virtually every one of the 12 members of the 12 in his home, fed them, he held meetings in his home. They loved him, he loved them, et cetera, et cetera. Then he shows up in Utah. I mean, this is his territory. He's in Boston and they're in his home territory. Now he's out in the middle of the wilderness, alone in in Brigham Young's theodemocracy, where Brigham Young rules, and there is not a mention of him in anyone's journal. They're not, oh, Walker Lewis is here, let's have a party and let's entertain him. No, there's utter silence. We know he got a patriarchal blessing there. We know he met Jane James and asked her to be his wife. And then we know he left. But during the period that he was there is when all this is happening. And I think this is Brigham Young telling him, back off, you're uppity, get out of my face, you don't belong here. But that's my speculation. There is absolutely nothing to prove that other than that he left. He did return to Lowell. There are no records of him continuing his participation in the Mormon Church. And the only thing that we do know is that when he died in 1856, he was buried by St. Anne's Episcopal Church, which he had previously belonged to. So I assume he did go back to the Episcopal Church.
Okay. I have a related broader question.
Okay, second question.
We know you mentioned the 1852, the additional anti-miscegenation law. Sorry if it's wrong. Later in Utah, you mentioned the Massachusetts revoking, but there were 42 of the 50 states that passed at one time the anti-miscegenation law.
Yes.
And we also have the 1968 Loving decision.
67.
That went away with them. The last one was actually repealed in 1991. In a broader context, do you...
The last one was 2000, actually, wasn't it? Alabama had... Or, it was one of the... One of the one of the southern states, finally.
Do you view the Mormons as any more or just a reflection of the, as you call, lower middle class society they sprang from?
Ooh, I think they're wholly part of the society that they came from. That just a pure reflection of kind of lower middle class white values. Yes. Okay. Yes, Camila.
How did that interracial marriage work in Utah with other races? because I remember when I was a child that my Sunday school teacher married an Indian, and she wasn't able to be married in Utah.
A Native American?
A Native American. And she had to go to another state to do that.
I don't, Margaret, do you recall Native Americans? I don't recall that ever being part of the law. Initially in 1886, they made it African and Mongolian, which were the Chinese railroad workers. You could not marry. They later added what they called Malaysians, and that was Filipinos, but I don't think Native Americans were ever part of the anti-interracial marriage laws in Utah.
Yeah, there were instances where Mormons married Indians.
Yeah.
And it was kind of sanctioned as a way of the of becoming a white, the likes of race. That of course goes back to 1831, but it was perpetuated in Utah where there were prominent Latter-day Saints that did indeed have Indian wives or married Indian women.
Okay. Margaret, yes.
I hope I didn't miss this. My husband called me.
How's he doing? Okay.
Orson Hyde in 1847 chastised women who were hanging out with William McCary and seemed to be quoting from the Pearl of Great Price, which hadn't been canonized at that point, but said, "Will you follow a man who has no right to the priesthood?" That seems to me to be one of our first attempt, you know, before we have the 1852 stuff with Brigham Young, but a hint that there's something in the air.
Yeah, and that's in December of 47, and that's one of the significant findings, and it really focuses it even more for me, because I had looked at that issue carefully when I did my original study back in the 1970s, and I said, you know, sometime in the period between 1847 and 1852, that's when it was firmed up, but it appears that the real critical, what you say, the critical mass, when it really comes together, it appears to be December 1847. But they don't really publicize it or articulate it publicly until 1852, until all of these documents come out. There's some statements that are made that are recorded in the various journals and stuff like that in 49 and so on. But it really isn't definitively laid out in a coherent, comprehensive way, and they build on those statements that are made in 47. I think it's kind of interesting. The statements are made in December 47, and then those are taken and expounded upon and developed in Brigham Young's January 1852 speech, and then again in his February 1840. Yeah, it was the same the following month.
Yeah.
When, as you were showing the Thomas Colburn material, and I saw the name Bird, and I thought, is that Andrew Bird?
It is,
and
yeah.
And then you went to Andrew Bird,
yeah.
And you know how his life ended, I assume.
Alcohol, wasn't...
No.
Was he murdered?
He's involved with the lynching, the Sandra Harvey lynching.
That's right. He gets shot by an African American. That's right. Ironically,
Harvey subsequently lynched, and Andrew Burt is the bishop of the 23rd ward. And
Harvey was black too.
Yeah. Harvey was black, and so you have a mob crowd gathering, demanding the lynching, and dragging the body through the streets of Salt Lake.
Yeah.
So that's Andrew Burt.
That's Andrew Burt. Yes. And Margaret, I don't know of this quote that you just did of Orson Hyde telling the women of Winter Quarters not to follow Willie McCary, so I want that from you.
I think it's in Lester Bush.
Is it?
Yeah,
okay.
I
missed that.
it's in there. I can't remember what the contemporary document, but they have said Orson Hyde preaches a sermon against his doctrines. That's the reference made. It doesn't say what the sermon said, but it just has a very brief mention, and I think it's in one or more of the contemporary diaries or accounts of that period,
okay.
In 47, 48. Yeah.
Great. Any other questions? Over time?
Oh, geez. Oh,
is it lunchtime?
Not yet.
Oh, there's one more.
Session.
Okay.
One more session.
Darn. I'm hungry.